Hi, David Brancaccio here with part two of a special edition of the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. As part of our Divided Decade series, our year-long project looking back at the 2008 financial crisis, I recently sat down with former Senator from Connecticut, Chris Dodd, and former Congressman from Massachusetts, Barney Frank, for a rare joint interview at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. In the first half of our conversation, which you can find in our podcast feed, we discussed the frantic efforts to keep the economy from slipping into another Great Depression, the late-night meetings, last-minute votes, the bailout, and the political shockwaves still rippling through the country a decade later. Now, in part two, we dive into the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010, a law with the distinction of being one of the most sweeping financial reform bills in American history. We also talk about future threats that the law may or may not guard against.
So the law that has each of your names on it, it is very focused on fixing and shoring up the banking system and making sure the banking system isn't as vulnerable the next time. Were you fighting the last battle, fighting the last war? Because what could happen next, God knows what could happen next. Might be something else.
The war was still on. The war wasn't over. We ended the war. Yeah, it's like saying, well, when you were in World War II, when you were fighting Hitler, were you fighting the last war? No, we were fighting Hitler.
I mean,
what we were doing in the bill was, remember, this stuff was ongoing. So what we were fighting was that. And yes, we did, I think, substantially diminish the likelihood of those things happening again. We never said, nobody could say that'll be the end of everything. But it wasn't, this wasn't only looking back at history. We weren't fighting the problems of the New Deal. We were fighting an ongoing set of practices, and if we didn't put an end to them, they would have kept going.
And there's several points. I mean, underlying, which you cannot legislate, but the lack of confidence, consumer confidence, investor confidence had been shattered because of what had occurred. And so what we try to do with the bill is not eliminate future crises, they're going to happen, but create tools, new tools, the ones that Bernanke and Paulson claimed they didn't have. So the stress tests for banks, the transparency in the derivatives market, the creation of the FSOC, so that they could actually sit down together, consider that radical idea, and look over the horizon and say, are there product lines or institutions that are posing systemic risk?
I often envision as like the war room watching over the financial system.
You know, a law says they have to meet four times a year. They've been meeting 30 times a year on their own because they realize the value of
and
that's a very critical, really a huge asset for the future.
And an initiative to come out of the Senate, Jack Reed, we created the Office of Financial Research,
which was a set
of experts whose sole function was to look ahead and see what the problems might be. And by the way, the Trump administration, that's one of the things which they have underfunded. They couldn't abolish it statutorily because they just don't believe that we should be as ready. And I would just add one other thing, that list that Chris gave, and this was the one area that Paulson and Bernanke did complain. I mean, you saw it in Lehman and AIG, the opposites. When Lehman failed, they didn't do anything. When AIG was going to fail, they did everything. And what they said was their lawyers had told them if a major institution couldn't pay its debts, they either had to let it go bankrupt and pay nothing or step in and pay everything. And the key thing that we did in what's called orderly liquidation was to give them the authority to move in, take over the institution, and pay only some of the debts, enough to keep things from spiraling out of control, and then levy on other financial institutions to get that money back. So that was another important piece.
And one more piece, which Barney brought up last night, and they're still angry about it. Too big to fail, not only politically, because you're not getting away with what we were able to do in 2008, but legally you cannot do it. They wanted to leave open the window so that a major financial institution could get financial aid to bail them out.
That there could be a future bailout.
And we shut it down. Now, they could change the law.
In fact, we teased and some of the experts, even Bernanke and Paulson and Geithner, who we work with, if you ask them, they've been supportive, and unlike a lot of other Republicans, they believe that what we did with derivatives, what we did with bank capital, what we did in these regulatory things were fine. But they are upset that we did shut down too strongly the possibility of unlimited infusion of taxpayer funds into failed institutions.
Well, they just wrote a piece in common in
fact,
the New York
Times.
At
the dinner they had last night, and Chris and I were there, and when they got through talking, I said, maybe a little mischievously, oh, by the way, I have a question for you three guys. How are you doing lining up sponsors for that bill you're pushing that's going to give back the authority to do all the bailouts? And I got laughter in return.
But there's a very serious point here, which is there. You didn't outlaw future crises.
No, you can't do that. That's
right.
What
so say. Something might happen, and what well, if they got to go back to Congress?
In the first place, in a democracy, yes, sometimes you do. And by the way, we showed last time that there was the capacity. That was Chris's point. They went to Congress, and Congress responded in two ways. And that's what we dealt with the crisis, and then we put in a pretty good set of rules. But again, I called my husband. He said, well, first you guys were the EMTs, and then you were the surgeons. And the result was a pretty good one. But here's the deal. We have given them the authority to intervene, but they have to put the institutions out of business, which some of the institutions don't like. Here's the issue. We have said that you don't want unpaid debt spiraling through so that A can't pay B and then B can't pay D, E, and F, and they can't pay the others. But they have to put the institution out of business. And what they're saying is, well, maybe we want to go that far. And the other thing I would say is this. If that's the issue, then the country has to decide it. Make this explicit. What they've said is what we did in there, the ability to put a major institution out of business and then pay only some of the debts, that's not going to work, because if a really big financial institution is threatened, there would be great political pressure to save it. So therefore, they would need the money to save it rather than put it out of business. And having gone through what we went through, we know that's wrong. In fact, if a big financial institution was failing, there would be political pressure to shoot everybody in it, not to save them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, because this was the vulnerability politically we faced all the way through this. The too big to fail. In fact, there was memos passed around Republican circles, how to defeat the bill, say it's too big to fail is still alive and well. We actually lowered the threshold for prudential supervision to $50 billion, which we just fundamentally changed. That was driven by Republicans because they constantly said too big to fail is still alive. Put aside whether politically you could do it or not, substantively that was the case. The very first amendment that passed the Senate in the consideration of the bill was a amendment offered by Richard Shelby and myself, which basically called an end to too big to fail. But we had to emphasize that point. The too big to fail was behind it. Had we not done that, I think this would have been a difficult bill to pass. And I needed 60 votes, not 51. I needed 60. And all I got was 60. One less, and the bill's dead on this thing. But for Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, and the new Senator Scott Brown from Massachusetts, we were able to get the 60th vote and pass the legislation. But too big to fail was always...
We did, and what we put it instead, and it was in both versions, and we then had to reconcile it, as we call in the conference, no bank is too big to fail. They fail. What we have said is, if they can't pay their debts, then we put them out of business.
In an orderly way.
And that's what it's called. And by the way, it anticipates that it may be that they got so indebted that the federal government will have to put in some money, but there's a mandate. Treasury Secretary then has to get that back from others. But the other point is this, is that we all the rules we put in about capital, restrictions on bad loans, on restricting derivatives, requiring that derivatives be funded, we made it much less likely that they would have that degree of debt. But even if that fails, and they do have more debt than they can pay off, they get put out of business, and the debt is paid in part, not entirely, only as much as you have to, and we get that back.
Let me switch topics here. In the law, you called it the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection. It came to be known as the
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The Bureau got switched.
Yeah, it got switched recently. It's being reined in by the present managers of it. What do you think? Is it doomed,
No, here's the deal. As much as the conservatives hate it, let's be clear what they hate about it. It's been very successful. Chris had the statistics where he told you how much money they brought in for people. There was this philosophy that goes
back... $12.4 billion in relief to over 31 million consumers is the claim.
It goes back to Ronald Reagan's government is not the answer to the problem. Government is the problem. It's deeply rooted in conservative philosophy that the private sector brings all the good and the government does only harm. And here is a case where the government is protecting citizens against the private sector. And they hate that the way the devil hates holy water. It is absolutely, it hurts their theology. So that's why they get so excited about what's really not the major piece of the bill. And so what they're doing is not enforcing it. But here's the point. It's still so popular that for all that they hate it, there's been no legislative effort to diminish its powers or change its structure, unlike health care, where they kept doing that. And so, yes, as long as Donald Trump is president, it won't use its powers. But as soon as you get a more sensible president, all those powers will be fully there to be reused.
Right, but no legislative changes, but they are changing the CFPB's ability. I'm just going to call it the Bureau from now on. That's what you call it in the bill a lot of times, the Bureau.
By the way, can I just say something?
Yeah.
Call it whatever you want. Who cares?
Yeah. Maybe it needed a better name to start with. But the Bureau...
Are you serious? People get hung up on the... That's not the issue.
No, of course it's not the
issue. But the point is this. Yes, they are not using it now. But it will be fully in effect the next time a president comes in who believes in it.
Well, because we did, let me just tell you, having had a lot of meetings before we even got close to passing the financial reform bill, meeting with the top 13 financial institutions, a block or so from where we're sitting today, and asking them, in preparation for going ahead, what are the things that you're most concerned about? There were two in an hour-long meeting, executive compensation and a consumer protection bureau. That was it. Those two. And I could tell you who was in the room, you'd know every name in the room. And that was their concerns.
And it's because it's ideological. They hate the notion.
Hate the idea.
This has vindicated our view that the government can protect the citizens against abuse by the private sector with no harm to the economy. By the way, that's the other point that I want to stress right here. Trump and a few of his allies keep talking about how our bill has crippled the financial sector and done all this damage. But at the same time, they argue this is the strongest economy we've ever had. Now, how is it possible to cripple a critical aspect of the economy, and still the economy works better than ever did?
And the two great arguments were, it'll destroy profitability and lending. Profitability last quarter was $60 billion, $12 billion above of the quarter previous quarter.
Banks have been very profitable.
Yeah, and the borrowing is $100 million more, and the balance sheet's going up. So people are lending money, the banks are profitable, and yeah, certainly maybe the tax bill may have had some impact, but the idea that this bill that we passed was going to kill both profitability and lending is ridiculous on its face.
It's just interesting to me that the Bureau is being cut back to the benefit, you would argue, yeah, the benefit of parts of the financial services industry that doesn't like it. But does the public, there's no outcry in support of the Bureau. People, this is just happening.
A couple of reasons. First of all, it's not that visible. It's hard to demonstrate. Again, it is hard to demonstrate things that they should have done and didn't. On the other hand, their recognition that it's popular, they won't let it be an issue. You say it's being cut back. The powers are not being used, but what do they hate? Well, they don't like the fact that it's funded automatically without going through the appropriation
budget.
That's
the biggest
problem. Which the Senate did. They haven't tried to change that. They don't like the fact that it's a single director rather than a commission. They haven't tried to change that. They haven't legislated anything because none of them want to vote to cut it back. So if you simply have an administrator who doesn't use the authority, that's hard to dramatize.
But you ask a good question, because I think this is what was clearly part of our thinking, and that is the funding scheme. Because what normally happens is so beyond the realm of news every day, and that is starving an agency.
Congress can tweak the purse strings.
And that's how you kill them. You don't kill them by, you know, it's no longer a question of a coup d'etat. It's just sort of destroy the institution.
But Congress can't in the case of the Bureau. They can't do it. You set it up with this cool
system. I would have, frankly, with the bill, I would have liked to have self-funded the SEC. If we could, and make it, because it certainly collects enough money to pay for itself every year from bad behavior. And so we did this through the Federal Reserve System, specifically to avoid what they did with the Federal Trade Commission and others over the years, starve them to death. And the public doesn't really get that.
And that hasn't changed. So I agree, yes, under Trump. But, you know, by the way, that's true of the Environmental Protection Administration.
Yeah.
It's true of a lot of things. You get people in power who don't believe in using the tools. There's no way you can force them to use them.
I mean, you saw the head guy from the Bureau who does student loans quit not too long ago.
But again,
says
when
not
you get if the next time a president gets in office who believes in this, those powers are there. They have not been diminished going forward. They're not being used.
I want to go slightly back in time before we leave the subject of the Bureau. I didn't get the story from you, Chris Dodd. In late 2008, I think it is, before we're at crafting Dodd-Frank and we're dealing with TARP, you identify the crucial issue for the government's response to be something like restoring consumer confidence.
Yeah.
But what was the story? Apparently the other tycoons in the room with you didn't get what you were saying. They looked at you, what, blankly?
No, and I'll tell you another quick anecdote to make my point to you. I was talking to a manager some years ago of a sovereign wealth funds, which this guy parked a huge amount of the country's money in our country. And I said, why do you do that? I mean, I'm just curious, you know, why you do that. He said, oh, for two reasons. He said, first of all, you're pretty good at making money. He said, but I want to tell you something. The second reason is actually more important than the first. He said, I'll never forget what he said. He said, I've never lost a wink of sleep worrying about the fairness, the stability of the system. I've made money. I've lost money. But I've never worried about the integrity of the financial services system in the United States. And what happened is we lost that reputation through all of this. And so confidence, while I can't legislate it, everything we had to do was designed to restore confidence, hopefully, and secondly, to make sure that the policemen on the street, if you will, the regulators, would have enough information to make good decisions. I can't force them to do that. They could disregard all of that if they want to. But don't ever tell me again we didn't give you the tools to identify a problem and respond to it accordingly.
You would think that would be self-evident, but apparently people didn't understand what you were saying at
first. Short-term thinking. It's quarter-to-quarter stuff. It's, you know, I'll get my 5 years in and get out in a lot of cases, you know.
But I got to go back to this thing about, without the financial crisis, do we or do we not get Donald Trump? Regular human beings lost faith in the system. They think that maybe the social contract before the crisis was something like, well, let the plutocrats do what they got to do, but they're watching out for us. They won't let it fall apart. Yeah. It started to fall apart, and now people are like, no, they're not watching.
What's going on? You got Turkey, you got Hungary, you got Poland, you got Austria, you got the Philippines, you know. We're seeing, you know, this kind of governance emerge globally. It isn't just here.
Nationalist governance.
Yeah.
The financial crisis accelerated it and accentuated it, but that's not the underlying problem. The underlying problem is the nature of growth in developed societies since the 80s, and this is now acknowledged. Growth from the Depression through World War II and the post-war period, growth was good for everybody. We grew developed economies in a way that helped the high-end people, it helped working people. They could go make glass, make autos, etc. And then, beginning in the 80s, and this is, I think, fairly well acknowledged, growth began to be a two-edged sword. It produced more overall wealth in a country, but it exacerbated the way in which it was distributed. So if you were high-end in America or in other developed societies, if you had a lot of skills, a lot of education, sophisticated in technology, you made money. If your only working asset was an ability to go work hard without a lot of skills, you could hurt. And so I think that's the basis for Trump or for Brexit or for the five-star movement in Italy. It is that economic growth in the developed West has evolved to the point where it has a very unequal effect in the economy. And you have Thomas Piketty talking about how capitalism has become both an increaser of wealth and an increaser of inequity. Now, what happened was, and I do agree when you talk about the plutocrats, I think what happened was in 2010, the perception that the bailout was only for the banks and not others convinced a lot of people that this unequal result was not simply the workings of an impersonal economy, but the elite was trying to screw them. So that added to it. But the underlying problem has been the economic reality, and that's been an ongoing issue. Not just in America, but in, and I was just reading a very good article by two economists at MIT in 2007, talking about how we are having this increasing inequality in the society, and that is undermining faith in democracy.
And someone comes along and promises that I can make you great again, and sort of obliquely refer to a time that Bonnie's just described here when those opportunities existed, and failing to recognize that automation and technology and all of these other matters have intervened in a way, make it difficult for that 50-year-old guy who's just lost his job, who's sitting in a VFW hall and watching his kids move back into the house, and someone comes along and says, I can solve your problem.
So what do you do about it from your perspective?
I do believe that the Democrats have to be more explicit. Well, here's the deal. And I do have differences with both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who each tried to do a lot to offset the unequalizing effect, but not enough. And I think what happened was people on the liberal side have still accepted a framework in which growth is the dominant goal. And then recognizing that growth will cause some problems, after you promote growth, you then deal with the question of the inequality it brings. And I think you have to make them equal. And the example in both cases is trade. I wish that both Clinton and Obama both did with trade was say, look, trade is good. It helps the whole economy. It hurts some people, so let's pass a trade bill, and then we will work on helping the people who are hurt. And the problem was that the conservatives, the business community, the Republicans said, okay, we'll help you pass a trade bill, but then when you want to do something to promote unions or to promote increase people's health care, we're not with you. So I think going forward, the liberal position has to be, yes, we are going to promote economic growth, but integral to that are going to be ways that we deal with the unfairness and offset that unfairness at the same time.
Even when mainstream economists say, wait, dealing with inequality, that's inefficiency in economic terms.
Yes, and I think that's the mistake that mainstream economists have been making. I think that it's time to go beyond growth as the number one issue. And in America today, the fact is, and this has been the case for 20 years, and it's getting worse, growth has a very unequal effect. And by the way, they may not like this, and this goes back to what we were talking about before. What some of the business community has to understand is they don't have the option of doing that anymore. I mean, they got Donald Trump. They got Brexit. They're getting the five-star movement. Look, it's like, I think it's like it was 90 years ago when there was...
90 years ago.
Nine years ago, there was a loss of faith in democracy because capitalism wasn't producing enough wealth. And you got Keynes, and you got this new idea that governments had to produce wealth. And so you then, beginning in the 30s and then into the post-war period, okay, democracy looks okay now because it's producing the wealth. But I think what we're seeing today is in some ways like that. Mm. That is, yeah, producing wealth is no longer enough to sustain faith in democracy. You've got to produce the wealth in a way that promotes fairness as well.
And they don't, and also it's a problem, the language about dealing with the inequality of taking care of the unemployed worker, that guy I just described it, seems sort of flat to me. I mean, it's, we'll have job training programs or something. We use the same language for three or four decades.
And well, Charles Schumer used it with his new way forward that he offered last year, which was one of the three planks was training.
Yeah, can you imagine? We have 2 years with an infrastructure, huge set of problems in the country. You would think both Republicans and Democrats, given the absolute need of infrastructure improvements and so forth, where real jobs could be created, would make some sense to do it. But too often the language doesn't seem to have the vitality that growth does, economic growth.
A major factor in the erosion of the incomes of average people, economists now will agree, has been the anti-union activity. It's frustrating to us that Trump talks about the working people and does such anti-union stuff. Well, there were a couple of things that would help. Raising the minimum wage and helping people with their medical care costs. Expanding Medicare in some way, either lowering the age or having a public option. Those are things that respond to that. And I agree that I think both Obama and Clinton were slow to see the need to make sure that pro-growth and pro-fairness went together. The next time you see a Democratic majority in the House or the Senate going forward and in the presidential campaign, there will be a much more explicit set of programs, increasing health care, minimum wage, protecting unions, that deal with this.
Let's get back to Dodd-Frank. This one of the crucial achievements of both of you has each of your names on the law.
Originally the motion was to call the bill Frank Dodd. And Bonnie pointed out at 4:30 in the morning, they'll think it's one person. We can't have that out.
Frank Dodd.
Yeah.
Okay. Good old Frank Dodd. Who is he? Was he in the House or Senate? You were fighting the war, you make the point, in this discussion, in real time, as you're working on that bill. So how much could you take on? But there's a lot to worry about in the financial system that Dodd-Frank doesn't fully address. A lot of financial stuff goes on outside of banks, in hedge funds and money market funds. They call it the shadow banking system.
Well, the bill does give them the authority to deal with that. The bill doesn't just regulate banks, and this is one of the things that we're proud of. Chris talked about the Financial Stability Oversight Council. It gives them the right to go after activity. So they've done some stuff about money market funds. In fact, I was talking to Janet Yellen yesterday, who was concerned that there may not be much willingness to use some of the authority they have. But the FSOC did make some changes in the requirements for money market funds. So the law does not just cover banks. It obviously covers financial institutions. It doesn't cover hedge funds as fully. That I agree with. But it has the right to step in if they see there's an issue.
It's a major problem. This is one of the major complaints of the bill. The fact that GE, MetLife, and a few others, where we looked at these non-sort of shadow banking, not your classic definition, and that people have complained that this was overreaching, in a sense. Now, you can make a case, depending upon the circumstances of each one, and there's some legitimacy to that. But the pace of legislation allows, except in the area of hedge funds, for us to actually be directly involved with institutions that don't specifically qualify as a bank.
Yeah, for instance, GE, because of what we did, divested itself of its financial entity. GE started out as an industrial company. Then they went into being a big financial company. And to avoid the supervision they were getting, They divested that. And even as to hedge funds, per se aren't regulated, but the financial instruments in which they deal are. For instance, derivatives. Nobody now can get involved in these massive derivative transactions, putting nominally hundreds of billions at stake, without there being a protection against somebody incurring debt that they can't pay off. They go through exchanges. You have to post margin. You have to have capital.
People may not understand that before Dodd-Frank, this is all kind
totally
of mysterious.
Opaque. Right? Totally opaque.
It's opaque. Yep. Yeah.
And you, well, AIG, here's the story, came to the Fed in September and said, we have $85 billion in debt we can't pay off. A week later, Bernanke said to us, oh, and we're going to need $85 billion for AIG. We said, oh, you already told us about that. He said, oh, I'm sorry. That's an additional $85 billion. It turns out AIG was $170 billion in debt beyond what they could pay off because they had been allowed to make promises without putting up the capital. And so what we changed in the law was it would be literally impossible to get $170 billion in debt now without having some capital to pay it off. You know, people know about margin for stocks. Well, yeah, you had to put up margin when you were buying stocks. You had to put up a certain percentage. But you could make a commitment with derivatives with nothing at all behind it.
Now, you've thought about this a lot, Congressman Franco. Does Dodd-Frank go far enough to make the regulators
it goes
really
as far
crack
as you
down?
Can. You can't push on a string. You can. I mean, it's always the case you can stop people from doing bad things, but I don't know how you could do much more, especially since some of them are necessarily qualitative. I will say this, though. Even with the Trump administration, that bill is being administered much better than people might have thought, and the system is being run much more soundly and safely than it was before the bill was passed. And the reason is that the powers are there, and unless you're a pretty irresponsible guy or woman, and you're in charge of an agency, and it has the powers to do something, you're going to be a little worried in the back of your mind that if you vigorously don't use those powers and something goes wrong, you're going to be in trouble. I do think that the Trump people probably are, some of them may be more willing to hold back. But the powers, and by the way, if you look at some of the regulators, Jay Powell, the new head of the Federal Reserve.
Very good.
There's no difference between the way he is administering those powers and the way Janet Yellen
did. Done a good job.
You're going to say?
Well, Jay Powell, I think, is very good. We're lucky to have him in that job.
We're talking about inequality before. Mm. I haven't asked you more directly about executive compensation. Average pay for all CEOs is up 72% between 2009 and last year. Last couple of years, some if not a lot of that jump has been the rising stock market. But the typical worker's pay is essentially flat. It keeps staying essentially flat. Dodd-Frank deals with that through, the main mechanism is transparency, right? That's what you tried to do?
Well, say on pay, we did a lot of different ways.
Fancy.
We don't force it. But I know they don't like it. And you know, once every 3 years, the boards can vote on these things here. It's a, you know, it's a difficult area to legislate in because of the opposition was so strong to this. I mentioned earlier to you the two issues that I was told over and over again, compensation and the Consumer Protection Bureau, were the two really big points to this.
We gave the shareholders the right to control the top executive compensation. Yeah. On the whole, they haven't used it again, but they have used it some. Vikram Pandit lost his job as a CEO of Citicorp because of a negative vote. Say on pay goes beyond transparency. It lets the shareholders vote every year.
Yeah.
They can do it as much if they want to wait till every 3 years, but they have to give the shareholders a vote at least once every 3 years on the compensation of the top executives. And if the shareholders can vote no, and nobody's going to defy that. The other is the publishing the ratio.
The CEO pay over the typical
average
worker's
pay.
Average.
And while that's not binding, apparently it has some effect because the CEO hated it like poison.
The argument, you know what the argument is. The argument is it makes CEOs look especially bad if it's a type of industry that has a lot of lower paid workers.
Well, then if I were them, I'd go to work in another industry. I mean, the notion that, oh, poor CEO... who's making $27 million, we hurt his feelings. That's tough. If you have those
it is
kind
very
of
embarrassing, though, when you show up on the wrong part of that list.
Well, that's true.
Good. Then take another job. By the way, live on $20 million instead of $27.
Related issue that, again, this doesn't get a lot of attention, obviously, the say on pay. Also related to that is the whistleblower provisions of the bill.
Very important.
Which was it was controversial. And frankly, I think Bonnie and I both had our reservations a bit about it. The idea would possibly see a deluge of whistleblowing accusations because you can bypass the business you work for and go directly to the FCC.
With anonymity.
with anonymity.
Yeah,
and of course, SEC was worried about it. It turned out all of our fears, whatever fears we had, non-existent. They've been a great success and made a difference in the last several years.
You know, yes, we've tried to cap CEO, at least restrain CEO pay, but more importantly, we're trying to raise the pay of the workers. I mean, with unions and with better taxation and with other factors that would increase their pay.
We've been talking about the achievements of the Dodd-Frank law, but what worries you most now about the financial system? Surely your worries are not over.
My worry is that I don't know what will happen next. Here's the position with the financial system and others. The private sector innovates, and at some point, the innovations outstrip existing regulations. And the mistake is, if you wait too long, that was the problem in the 90s and the 2000s. It wasn't so much deregulation as non-regulation. Brooksley Bourne tried to get the government to do something about the derivatives. We tried to get Alan Greenspan to do something about the by the way, you said, let me just be clear about Alan Greenspan. In his memoir in 2006, Economics in the Time of Turbulence, he said, I'm getting this almost verbatim, I think it was on page 206, you could look it up, as Casey Stengel used to say, I know that these subprime loans carried a high risk that they would not be repaid, but it was a risk worth taking because you cannot have a capitalist system unless there is broad support for property rights. And by making these loans, we encourage a lot of these people to be supportive of property rights. It's a political, ideological justification for allowing loans to be made that he said, quote, had a high risk of not repayment. So, I mean, but here's what I'm afraid of, is that we will see a repeat of this, that I don't know what the next set of innovations will be. My fear is that there will be innovations that will, in part, be designed to get around existing regulations, and the regulations won't catch up quickly enough. It'll depend, you know, who's in power.
Chris Dodd?
Yeah, two things. Well, the thing is less directly involved in specific financial institutions, but I think the debt issue domestically, both at the national level, the state level, the community level.
So national level, this is government borrowing, but also corporate debt, risky corporate debt.
I think it's a huge issue that's looming out there. I think it's regrettable in some ways. I mean, the fact that we're still 10 years later, not just a matter of history talking about this, but in fact, there are bills being introduced all the time to try and undo what Barney and I did. You know, you've got things like fintech, you've got cybersecurity, you've got data issues. If I were chairing the committee today, I'd be looking, those are the issues that I think are rather on the cutting edge of the stability and soundness of our financial institutions. Instead of worrying about, you know, the Volcker Rule, per se.
Or I mean, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, you would argue.
Why aren't you looking at these real, you know, and some of them are exciting, by the way. I'm not suggesting we ought to be opposed to them. I think fintech offers some unique opportunities. The Bitcoin issues and so forth, why not just reject that out of hand? Seems to me smart, intelligent people ought to be looking at it to determine whether or not these are offering new opportunities for people to grow wealth, create jobs, and the like. So debt and these legitimate issues that are out there today that didn't exist 10 years ago.
If people ask, where are we on the bill? The best witness for how successful we were with financial reform is Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump brags all the time about how wonderfully the economy is performing. This is a terrific economy. This is such a great economy. Well, one of the essential pieces of a well-functioning economy is its financial system. And it simply would be impossible logically for the economy to be doing wonderfully if we had crippled the financial system. It cannot be that we are doing so well in terms of how the economy is functioning, but the banking system was broken. And in fact, what we have is a financial system that is working very well to do what it's supposed to do, which is to provide the money that is needed for productive activity, but has substantially diminished the chances of the kind of crisis we had before.
Has the president thanked you for all your hard work on this that allowed his
success? I don't know. I don't read his tweets as regularly as I should, so maybe there's one in there.
Barney Frank represented Massachusetts in the House for 32 years. Chris Dodd represented Connecticut in the Senate for almost the same stretch after many years in the House. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
That was former Congressman Barney Frank and former Senator Chris Dodd. Now, we have videos, articles, and a complete transcript of the interview. The Marketplace team also added what we hope is a helpful glossary of terms for some of the wonkier things being discussed. It's all at marketplace.org.
A confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.